You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
It is indeed time for Dear Science. And science, we will be hearing, dearing? We'll be talking about some science. We've got lots of science today.
I've had a better intro.
I've certainly... Well, I mean, now that I've done them for a year, I'm sort of running out of new
science-related
puns to make. But we've got some science-related fun to be had.
Oh, geez.
No, it's not too bad.
Trying
good.
Too hard today.
Yeah, perhaps. with this meteorite, I've been fascinated with meteors. Well, I was fascinated at the age of 5. My fascination probably waned a little bit since then, but they're still quite interesting.
Yeah. Yep.
And we've got a big impact crater over the ditch.
We do, indeed.
What's going on there?
And the interesting thing is they've only just found it.
Wow.
Which is kind of cool.
How do you only find that now, right?
Exactly.
You'd think pretty big.
Yep.
How do you miss it?
Well, okay, so let's sort of segue back to the question of how old is the Earth? Because this is very important in this discussion that we're going to have.
Right.
So the Earth's around about 4.5 billion years old. And the way that they figured that out is essentially they're looking at radioactive dating of rocks on planet Earth. Okay. And also rocks on the moon and also meteorites as well. And now the reason that they have to sort of look at rocks on the moon and meteorites rather than rocks on the Earth per se is that we've got tectonic plates on planet Earth.
Yes, wiggling everything around.
And what this means is that the rocks on the surface sort of get subsumed.
Yeah.
They sort of go round
right.
And they go back into the interior and they melt and then they form new rocks. They come up back up to the top and blah, 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 blah. So in terms of really, really old rocks, there are not very many.
Right,
because
that makes sense.
They undergo these processes and everything where they melt and then reform and blah, 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 which is why we need to look at meteorites and rocks on the moon.
Yeah.
Okay, and that gives us sort of the idea of the age of
planet Earth. It's a better example, yeah.
So what they've just found in the Pilbara region of Western Australia is now the oldest impact crater on planet Earth.
Yep, which is pretty, I mean, that's got to be pretty old, right? We've got a fair few meteorite craters, I'd imagine.
Well, that's the interesting thing. As we'll talk about. So this crater that they've found, they've now dated at 3.47 billion years old. Okay.
Yep.
Earth is 4.5 billion years old. This
pretty early
crater
on.
Is around about 3.47 billion, but the next oldest, the record that it's just beaten, was 2.2 billion years.
Oh, okay.
So that's a heck of
a billion year jump.
it's
unfathomable,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And okay, so you're talking about we've probably got lots and lots of impact craters on Earth. There are 190, which surprises the heck out of me. So there's only 190 known impact craters on Earth. Okay.
I assume there's been more meteorites, though.
Oh heck yes.
Yeah.
But the problem is that as we've got an atmosphere in them, they all burn up,
burns them out.
So you only get the real biggies.
Yeah.
Of those 190, 44 of them measure 20 or more k's across. Okay, so if you can imagine a 20-kilometer impact crater.
Yeah. And how impacted are these craters? Are we talking a crater, or is it sort of just an indent?
Well, that's the thing. You might think a big old impact crater would be really easy to see, but as these guys in Oz have proved, no, it's not necessarily.
Mm.
Now, if you're familiar with an impact crater, chances are it would be the one in Arizona. You've probably seen a photo of the meteor crater in Arizona. I've actually been there. It's extraordinary. And it sticks out like a sore thumb because it's right in the middle of, big flatlands and everything.
Yeah, you can see it on Google Maps as well.
And you can absolutely see that. And the biggest in the world, which, again, I didn't know, is a thing called the Vredefort Dome in South Africa.
Hmm.
And that was thought to be roughly about sort of between 200 and 300 kilometres wide when it was formed originally.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was formed as a result of an object they reckon is about 15 kilometres diameter.
Yep.
Travelling at a speed of 15 kilometres per second.
So, quite quick,
That's going to make a big...
That's a big impact.
Yeah. Okay. And that was... yeah, they think about sort of 2 billion years ago that that happened. And the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, the one that we all know about, that was about 66 million years ago, and that was in the Yucatan Peninsula around Mexico, in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. Yeah,
As it is called. So what's so special about this one on the Pilbara is that it's not obvious, okay? It's not an obvious crater like these ones that I've talked about. You can't sort of see it from ground level and stuff like that. But they know that there's lots of really, in fact, some of the really oldest rocks on planet Earth are around the Pilbara region in Australia, okay? And the way that they've figured this out is the presence of these things called shatter cones. So
shatter cones.
When you've got these big old asteroids or meteorites or meteors, or call them what you will, and they are coming through Earth's atmosphere at massive speeds, ridiculous speeds, they set up a shockwave, basically. Okay, so they're preceded by a shockwave, and this massive, massive, massive shockwave fractures the rocks below it, and it fractures them in the shape of a cone. Okay, and the pointy end of the cone then points towards the center of the impact.
Right, okay. so that's
all basic physics. And so what they've done in the Pilbara is that they've found a whole lot of these shatter cones.
Yep.
So they've been, you know, digging around
working
and stuff like
out
that.
Where they are.
Found these, figured out that, yep, they're in very, very, very old rocks. So that means this is a very, very,
it's
very,
very
old impact crater.
Right.
And they reckon, again, they don't know because they can't see it from above necessarily.
Yep.
They reckon the crater might be something about 100 kilometres across, which means that, again, this is one of the big suckers that managed to get through. And, you know, possibly the reason that we don't get struck too often is the fact that we do have an atmosphere.
Yeah.
And that these things just burn up in the atmosphere, thank goodness. And, you know, back in those days, the atmosphere was very probably not what we have today. It certainly wasn't as dense.
Right.
And so, therefore, we
less meteorological.
Yeah. And projection. I mean, if you want to know what we could look like, just look at the moon tonight.
Yeah.
Look at all the impact craters on the moon. You know, that's scary. It's the atmosphere that keeps us safe from these things.
But wouldn't want to be dealing with that.
So, you know, there we go. We've got this brand new crater and, you know, 3.47 billion years old. You can imagine that all of the geologists and co around there are just licking their lips in anticipation.
Very exciting.
Some fabulous science to be done here through identifying this very, very old and large crater.
Yeah, and speaking of atmospheres,
that's a good segue.
In the middle of the atmosphere, we've got a bit of an ozone layer, which was, I mean, it was certainly it's been more of the main topic of conversation in the past, sort of faded a little bit out. We used to talk a lot more about the hole in the
ozone layer. Yeah, no, you're absolutely
and
right.
And what's going on with it now? Let's catch up with.
Well,
good old ozone.
The interesting fact about the ozone layer, you might think, well, okay, so what ozone does basically is protect us from ultraviolet.
Yes.
Okay, all these ultraviolet rays coming from the sun, and they interact with ozone molecules and basically get deactivated, let's say. Okay,
yeah.
So we get absorption of the UV light and that keeps us safe. And it was in 1985 that it was first shown that there was an ozone hole, a hole in the ozone layer.
Wait, how does that even happen?
Well, there's there's the question.
Yeah.
So they were thinking that, and, you know, what the heck's going on here? Must be something that is in the atmosphere that's reacting with ozone. Now, ozone itself is a very reactive beastie. And amazing, this is the really incredible fact about the ozone layer. We think of this thing, you know, it's probably this massive, big, thick layer and everything. If you took the ozone layer and took it to atmospheric pressure, to one atmosphere pressure, it would be about 3 millimeters thick.
Wow.
That's it.
So we're dealing with, I mean, quite a potent amount of ozone here, right? Given that it's only 3 millimeters thick.
Yeah. It's a very, very reactive beastie.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's a very reactive beastie means that if we put stuff into the atmosphere it can react with, it will react with it and it will deplete it. And they found that the thing that we were putting into the atmosphere to deplete it were these things called chlorofluorocarbons or CFCs, you might be more familiar with. Okay. And a story I always like to tell was that CFCs were invented by a guy by the name of Thomas Midgley. Thomas Midgley.
Unfortunately.
In the States in around about the 1920s. Now, Thomas Midgley not only managed to lead to the semi-destruction of the ozone layer by inventing chlorofluorocarbons, he also was the first person to put lead in petrol.
Wow. That's a bit of a two-for-one on unfortunate...
Yeah. And he went to great lengths to show that petrol with lead in it was safe, even to the extent of sort of inhaling vast quantities of it. And,
that's incredible. He's really putting out numbers. Man,
possibly,
in
terms of the environment. But so that was basically it. They managed very quickly to see that there was these CFCs, these chlorofluorocarbons, and they were used in refrigerators mostly. They were refrigerants. Mm. They're also used sort of dry cleaning, stuff like that.
Yep.
And so very quickly the world got together and said, right, let's get rid of these things because, you know, we need our ozone layer. And so the world did start getting rid of these things. And what we've seen in recent years is the ozone hole has been closing up, which is all good. Okay, yeah. That's obviously what we want. But the question then becomes, is it closing up as some sort of natural atmospheric process that we don't know about?
Yeah.
Or is it closing up as a result of the fact that humanity, once in its life,
we did something.
And did something sensible. Yeah. Okay. So that's the question. So a bunch of workers at MIT, not the Manukau Institute of Technology, the other one.
Yeah, the more well-known MIT.
So they have now shown that it is, in fact, the absence of CFCs in the atmosphere that's leading to the ozone hole closing up. Okay. And the way that they did this was basically to model the atmosphere. And they modeled it in the presence of these CFCs that have been put into the atmosphere by humanity and in the absence. And they basically got down to a 95% confidence limit that it's the fact that we're not putting CFCs into the atmosphere anymore. So basically what we're saying is that, yes, humanity can make a difference if everybody gets together and does the right thing. Yeah, we can actually influence.
It's quite inspiring.
The environment in a positive way.
Aside from the fact that we made the problem in the first place. It's quite inspiring that we can fix it afterwards. If we all work together on that.
And the workers are sort of mentioning, you know, this, the ozone hole could be gone by 2035.
Yeah, which is not ideal, obviously.
Well,
what happens if we lose the ozone layer?
Oh, no.
The ozone hole being gone is ideal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, what so happens that, if that's we, what we yes. want. If we lost the ozone layer,
yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You wouldn't want to think about it.
No, yes. Because obviously UV causing sunburns is not great. But
your SPF 50 is probably not going to do the trick.
Anymore. Are there any... What else happens other than...
Well, it's just that. It's just these high energy particles coming from the sun. High energy radiation. And high energy radiation interferes with the molecules of life, cancers, etc., etc.
You know, so want to keep that around.
You don't want that. So we do want the ozone layer, and they reckon that it will be completely healed or could be completely healed by 2035, which would be brilliant.
I mean, that's ideal. I don't know why I misheard earlier. But now we've got a last one here. Memory loss.
Mm.
Linked to fat consumption.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, this is weird. You might sort of think, right, food, yes, you know that if you eat bad food, then it has an effect on your body.
Yes,
you
know, and that makes sense.
Bad diet, you know, we're talking obesity, we're talking diabetes, we're talking all of those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But does it have an effect on the brain? Does it affect the brain in the same way as it's affecting the body negatively? And the answer, according to these workers at Ohio State University, is yes, it does. And what they did was to study mice, rats, in fact, sorry, in this case. And what they did is that they took a wide variety of ages of rats and they started feeding them a very high-fat diet.
Mm.
And they would feed it to them for either 3 days or for 3 months.
And when we're talking about a high-fat diet, is this a proportional high-fat situation or is it like high-fat for rats? What are we...
That's a good question. It's just a high fat diet.
High fat diet.
So
okay.
Higher fat than they are normally used
than
to.
Than they're normally used to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what they then did, they subjected the rats to memory tests and, you know, all of these good things to see what was going on in their brains. And they also were analyzing the brains themselves for any sort of physical changes in the brains. And so what they found with it for the younger rats, it was fine, okay? They could go for 3 months on a high-fat diet. There'd be no obvious downturn in their memory performance, and there's no obvious physical changes in the brain. But the older rats, that's where the problems come, because they could feed the old rats the high-fat diet for 3 days.
Wow.
3 days, and they would find that the rats performed worse in memory tests. Okay, so forget the 3 months thing. 3 days will do the trick. Plus, they were seeing inflammations in the brain.
So risk of
So, well, basically what they're saying is that very probably that this memory, you know, this poor performance in the memory test is very probably related to the inflammation of the brain.
Right.
So that, you know, it's a causation thing. Chances are that seems to be what's going on. So it seems to be certainly an age thing, an age-related thing, that if you're on a poor diet as a rat at an old age.
How well do rats translate to people?
Well, there's the squillion-dollar question. Yeah. You know, if you could answer that question and get it right every time, then you'd probably be a squillionaire, I'd say. But, you know, it's obviously of concern that they've found this, and so it may well be that, it'll almost certainly be that human trials will then come into play, and they'll be looking for people who, you know, eat high-fat diets regularly, which is going to be anybody who exists on fast food, pretty much. And see if those same sort of things occur in the older generation as opposed to the younger generation. So it's an interesting result, and you know why there should be a difference in the age, in the ages, you know, in their response for young and old is anybody's guess. But you know, as we always say on Dear Science, more research is needed.
Yeah, and quite concerning. But I mean, maybe the research turns out that we're fine. Maybe we're better at eating fat than rats are. Or maybe we're worse. That wouldn't be ideal.
Well, that's why more research is needed, precisely. Yeah.
So we're looking forward to some more research, which we might end up hearing on another Dear Science show. Yeah. Thank you for coming in, Alan. Thank you, Moshet. And thank you, as always, to Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.